This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. This special live episode of The Joy of Text is sponsored by Twin Sons, exceptional California kosher wines, affordable and impressive by the winemakers of Shira. Welcome to The Joy of Text, a monthly podcast about Judaism and sexuality. We're coming to you before a live audience at the JCC in Manhattan. I'm Rebecca Honig-Friedman, and I'm here with Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, Clinical Director at Maze Women's Health and President of JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. We are so excited to be here today at the JCC, and we are also really excited to dig into our topic. Today we're going to talk about the Me Too movement. And later on we're going to hear from activist and writer and performer Talia Lakritz about her sex book club for Jewish women. And we're also going to hear from our audience, hear your comments and your questions.
You can get another woohoo for the audience, right?
Your audience. So without further ado, let's get started. Are you guys ready to talk about Me Too?
We are.
Ready.
Okay.
As I'll ever be.
Seems like every day another woman comes forward with a story about sexual harassment or sexual abuse that she experienced by the hands of a powerful man. And there's a feeling that women are finally being heard and believed when they speak out about their own experiences, and that men can no longer get away with despicable behavior simply because they're rich and powerful, or in some cases simply because they're male. But with this sense of female empowerment has also, I think for many, caused a sense of upheaval where we're questioning a lot of our long-held assumptions about sexually charged interactions from flirting to intercourse. So today we're going to try to make sense of some of these questions using Jewish law and Jewish values as our guide. And we'll also talk about maybe some of the limitations of Jewish tradition when it comes to these issues. So I think the obvious place to start is with modesty and yichud. We traditionally start with a listener question, and we're not doing that today, but we have gotten several questions from listeners or comments suggesting these practices are safeguards against sexual harassment and assault. So I wanted to start by asking, do you agree, and why or why not?
So there's two issues here. One is the tznius issue, and the other is the yichud. I think I'll address the tznius one to put it aside, because I've written about this and spoken about this in a lot of other contexts, but tznius, the way it's interpreted culturally, which becomes a woman's obligation to cover her body, is actually not reflective of the Talmud's approach and of halacha, really is deeply problematic because it sort of makes women responsible for men's sexual thoughts and reinforces woman as sex object, but just makes it her responsibility to hide that. And the Talmud actually is much more directed towards men. The Talmud is always like androcentric, speaking primarily to men. And the Talmud basically tells men not to look sexually at women who aren't their wives. This is not because the Talmud is proto-feminist, but just because the Talmud is concerned about men and men's sexual thoughts, and therefore it's speaking to men. Either way, that's a very important corrective in terms of, I think, a problem in larger society, and certainly I think within Orthodox culture, about the messages we send around these issues. And I think that the thing that I would learn from this is not that if women dress more modestly, somehow that will address the issue. First of all, I think that's a very questionable assertion, and I certainly don't think that the responsibility of this should be on the women. The responsibility of this should be on the men. I actually wrote about this once, an article in the New York Times, and somebody responded. It was actually, the letter was printed in the paper, and he's recorded how when there was a problem with some rapist that was at large in Jerusalem, the suggestion was raised that there should be a curfew after 10 p.m. for women, and Golda Meir said, no, there should be a curfew after 10 p.m. for men. So I think that it's a good place to begin.
Yeah, so I think anybody who suggests that tznius is going to keep a woman safe from sexual harassment is an idiot, okay? So we kind of know that, right? Otherwise, there would be no sexual abuse in any of the Haredi communities. So I think most of us, I'm assuming most of us, saw when Me Too first came out, Maya Bialik wrote a piece. She got totally slammed for the piece and for suggesting that tznius would therefore be something that solved the problem. So I remember being very struck by that because I didn't read in that Maya Bialik was suggesting that dressing Mort Sanua would safeguard you from rape or sexual abuse. Clearly, other people did read that in and were infuriated by that. And that goes back to the fact that women often, feel blamed, and they feel like everything turns out to be their responsibility. What occurred to me after I read that article and when I saw that huge backlash to Maya Bialik was that it felt like responses weren't so nuanced. People weren't really sort of separating out issues, talking about things in a way that reflected the complications of the factor. And so one of the things that I feel has been incredibly powerful is that the Me Too movement allowed women to have a voice and finally allowed women to speak up when they hadn't been heard and finally allowed them to be believed when they weren't believed. I also think that along the way, we may have lost some of the nuance. And what I'd like to hope to reclaim tonight is part of that nuance.
I'd like to push back, not that I disagree with anything you say, but in terms of making that an issue at this time. I mean, I agree that, a lot of the what we've seen in the last few months has been unnuanced. But at the same time, I also feel like Rambam gives a metaphor when somebody is trying to change a character trait. He says, if a tree is bent too much in one direction, if you want to make it straight, you don't make it straight. You bend it in the other direction. And I think we've spent like 3,000 years or 10,000 years with the tree being bent in one direction. So if we're bending it a little bit too much in the other direction right now, I mean, that's, I think, a necessary course corrective, and we can sort of get back to the middle or where we want to be. So that's like one thing. And I think related to this is that whatever we could say at some other time about sort of the tznius thing, I just think it's very unhelpful and unhealthy to be raising that issue right now. I think now is the time to be talking about men's responsibility, and it's counterproductive to be talking about sort of a tznius as a factor in this conversation, whatever we might say about it, like, you know, a year before or a year after this.
For once, I absolutely do not disagree with you about either of those topics. I think you're right. I think sometimes we have to overcorrect. I think we need to be conscious of the fact that we're overcorrecting, though.
So then let's talk about Yichud for just a moment. Mike Pence was in the news a while ago for his practice of never having a private interaction with a woman who was not his wife. From what I remember, he took Yichud farther than Orthodox Jews do.
Actually, could you just give us a sentence about Yichud? Define
sure.
Yichud?
The Gemara prohibits a man and woman who are not married to one another to be together in private and out of a concern, and it's actually questioned whether it's a concern about rape or concern about seduction, but either way, out of a concern of improper sexual activity between the two. Not that the Gemara believes that everybody is going to be always looking for an opportunity to have sex with somebody if they're in the same room with them, but that if you follow these rules and you're careful about this, it helps you live up to, the way I like to frame it is it helps you live up to your better self. If somebody wanted to sin, they're not going to follow the laws of Yichud. So that will raise a question about how helpful that will be in the current conversation. But if people want to do the right thing, then having these rules in place and having these sort of systems in place is a helpful structure to ensure that that happens. It allows us all to not be in opportunities that will be tempting and that will act in ways that we wish we would not have acted.
So it's so funny because the week that story came out about Mike Pence, I don't know if you remember this, Dove, but we were doing a live taping at Harvard. And we had a huge argument about it. Dove and I had a huge argument about it because I found it so irritating. My gut reaction to Mike Pence's not having a meal with a woman by himself, like it just felt sexist to me. But I hadn't had a chance to think about it or process it. And Dove said, well, I don't understand. Like, I think that if he finds that it helps him. So actually, a friend of my daughter's, I'm going to give a shout out to Ricky Heiklin. She made the following chiluk for me, the following distinction for me, which I thought was beautiful. She said, if you feel like you need rules in order to, as you put it, be true to your better self, then those rules are fine as long as they don't discriminate between women and men or in any categories, they're not discriminatory. So if Mike Pence is not going to have a meal alone with a woman, he should also not have a meal alone with a man. So I think, you know, laws of Yichud are all fine and good as long as they're not used as a smokescreen for discrimination, specifically discrimination against women. And I think we've seen that time and time again, that women's careers are put on a back burner because they're not part of the boys' club. Right. And so this is just making the boys' club and an even smaller club that you can't belong to. And it's really aggravating.
Right. Yeah, I actually fully agree with that. And I think that I mean, I'm not sure if it's a smokescreen, even if it's very sincere. The point is that the fallout and the cost of it is that it excludes women from positions of influence and power. So I am not sort of saying that I'm advocating that I think the best thing as a society we could do is if we adopt these rules of yichud, because it definitely comes at a significant cost. But I think that what we can learn from it is, and we in a way have already adopted this in many ways in society. I mean, people don't always follow it, but rules about, you know, if a rabbi is meeting with a congregant, you know, you have the room should have a window, you know, doors should be open. People, you take care, you know, about. I mean, we don't always do it, but we have an understanding that that's what you are supposed to do. Is if you want to care about these things, is you set up certain systems in place about when do you, what, you know, when do you have about not having private meetings, if you know, in ways in which could be open to abuse. So, so I think that the point is to set up those systems in ways that are equal between men and women, and that don't have the effect of excluding women from positions of influence and power.
So I also worry a little bit the subtext message that is being sort of sent out when we talk about sex this way is that the sex urge is so strong that people can't control themselves. You know, it's like another variation of in the day schools when they say to the girls, oh, you know, you have to be covered up because other the boys have these bad urges and you don't know what will happen. It's almost like we talk about sexual urges as if they're not controllable.
Well, I think we talk about men's sexual urges.
Correct. Yes. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Absolutely. We spoke about women's sexual urges, that they were uncontrollable. So I feel like the way we're talking about it, it does, to a certain degree, confirm that to people. Oh, you know, oh my God, a guy and a woman together in a room, he's not going to be able to help himself. He's going to be so turned on, he's going to assault her. Like, really?
Is that the assumption that the Talmud makes?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Talmud is concerned about the man initiating and not about the woman, although there's a fascinating debate in the poskim about whether yichud is directed at the man or directed equally. For example, if a man and woman are in adjoining hotel rooms, let's say, and a door is between them, is it enough that the woman locks the door on her side? So some will say, well, yeah, because then the man can't get in. And, you know, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg says, I don't know. He says, I looked at the entire Talmud and the whole Shulchan Aruch, and I don't see anywhere where it says that this is more about the man than about the woman. So he actually thinks a closed door is enough. But he said, if you needed a locked door, it wouldn't work that it's on the woman's side because she can always unlock it. So he actually is, I think, unusual in claiming that it's about a concern of how the woman will initiate. But overwhelmingly, the assumption is that it's a concern about the man, either initiating seduction or rape. But the one thing I'd say back, Bachev, is like, you got to deal with the problem. I know it's a problem that we're sending this message, but there is a reality that, you know, if you talk about like the fraternity parties and, you know, date rape and so on, that men sometimes are taking the opportunities that are available to them, and they wouldn't take it if those opportunities weren't available. So I don't know how we can be honest about the issue, you know, just because of certain like an ideological position that we don't want to be saying that men are always, under the sway of their sexual urges.
Right. I'm not arguing with your bottom line. I'm just alerting people to the fact that a subtext of that is that, you know, it makes it sound like these sexual urges just took me over. I couldn't handle it. You know what I mean? Like, and that's just A, it's a terrible message. And B, it almost in a weird way exonerates people, even though we're trying not to. So I'm going to not continue beating the dead horse, but that's
okay. all right. Well, let's move on. One of the more controversial episodes in this whole movement was the publication of an article about Aziz Ansari and a terrible sexual encounter that an anonymous woman had with him. And I don't want to get into the controversy about whether it should have been published or not, but I think it did open up or bring to the fore an important discussion about consent and this notion of affirmative consent, which is traditionally consent has been thought of as if you say no, that means no, but if you don't say no, we assume it's okay. Whereas affirmative consent says actually you need to have said yes actively in order for us to assume that you actually consented to an encounter. So I'm wondering, is there any kind of Jewish corollary or halachic notion of affirmative consent? And if not, what is the Talmudic notion of consent?
So here we get to another area in which the Talmud is not so helpful or whatever, relevant, I'll let you decide, in two ways. First of all, again, the line between sexual encounter with consent and without consent It's like you're not supposed to be having a sexual encounter without your spouse. But you could deal with the case about the spouse.
Let's make it about a marriage.
Right. So in a marriage, Talmud says that, you know, a man is not supposed to be having sex with his wife against her will. So exactly how is that determined, that line? You know, the Talmud basically, yes, what emerges from it, it doesn't sort of address it as a topic, but what emerges between the lines is that unless the woman is very clear and explicit, you know, that you should, assent is sort of like assumed unless it's clear that the woman is not consenting to it. So that's in the context of marriage. But what I will say is, like, the place where you have a difference between, you know, between them is that an act of rape is actually, like, treated as an act of physical assault. It doesn't have a separate category of rape, but it treats it as physical assault, whereas an act of seduction is obviously not, you know. That's the cases in the Torah. One is rape and one is seduction. But the question is, how do you define that line? And I think that the general assumption that emerges is that you sort of assume that it was with consent unless there's clear evidence that it was not.
Which brings us exactly back to the Aziz Ansari case, right? That we've come perfect full circle there, because this was a case where she clearly was not giving consent, but he didn't feel she was clearly not giving consent. And it just leads us back to, we need to kind of go to the root and re-educate men to be able to hear what women are saying, see what women are saying, be sensitive to the women's experience and position. And we need to be also supporting women so that they can say what they need to say, use verbal, you know, it's like as a mother, I'm always saying, when my kids were little, I was always saying, use your words, like use your words. We need to teach women to do that. And I understand that it's really hard and that women have to be given a certain sense of confidence and entitlement in order to be able to do that.
I would like to just add two models. One is disturbing and one is more helpful. The disturbing model is actually in the Torah, which is where it speaks about this case of rape and seduction. And it says if the act occurred in the field outside of the town, then you assume rape. Whereas if it occurred in the city, in the town, you assume seduction. Why? Because had she been raped, she would have called out and people would have heard. So there the sort of assumption is that by not calling out and screaming rape, you know, we assume that it is, at least as a legal matter, after the fact, which is not the question about how is the man supposed to act. I want to also be clear about that. This is a question after the fact, what can be prosecuted. But if he doesn't sort of explicitly call it out, then we assume that it was not rape. So that's one model. The other model, though, the Talmud says, is that if women were sort of held captive and there they were having sex with the captors and then providing food for them and cooking for them or whatever, and things that would indicate that they're consensual, the Talmud says, no, we assume that it's all out of fear, that, you know, the implicit threat of violence, even if not explicit, you know, and even if they're looking like willing participants, we have to assume that that's effectively rape and that that's out of the, you know, that that's out of fear. So those are like two very different models.
That's surprisingly progressive.
Yes.
Yes, surprisingly progressive. You know, it's so funny, about maybe a year, maybe a year and a half ago, way before the Me Too, the whole Me Too movement started, I saw a blog post that I remember just changed my way of thinking entirely. A woman was describing a situation where she went to a party, she saw some cute guy, she started flirting with him, then he offered to drive her home, she went to take a ride home, and then he said, I'm going to take you back to my apartment, and she was like, no, I don't really want to go, and he was like, yeah, just come up for a little while, and so she said she felt uncomfortable, so she just kind of went along with it, but then, you know, they walked upstairs, he was sort of pushing her into the apartment. She was actually at this point sort of physically struggling to stay out of the apartment. Some neighbor came out and he thought they were joking around, right? Like the guy, it was no question in her mind. The guy wasn't like abusing her, but there was sort of this sort of joking of, you come on in, I don't want to come in. Yes, come in. He's kind of yanking her. The neighbor laughed because he thought this was all, you know, sort of a joke or a cute. They came in and he essentially pushed her onto the bed and started kissing her. And she said, I said to him, listen, you're bigger than me and you're stronger than me. So if you want to have sex now, we're going to end up having sex now. But I just want you to know you're going to be raping me. And she said there was this total, it was like the mic drop. She said that he like froze And she realized at that moment that he, until that point, did not realize that he was pushing her to the point of where she was feeling raped. Like, the fact that there could be that miscommunication, she was sort of uncomfortable being strong about her position. She was sort of therefore joking around about her position. He assumed it was all just part of the joking and the game and just kept going. As soon as she sort of called it for what it was, he stopped. I remember when I read that and I was thinking to myself, oh my God, there is such a communication gap going on here. There's certain situations where it's not a communication gap. The guy is raping the woman. She's drunk. He doesn't care. He's forcing her. Weinstein is not, there was not a communication gap there. But I do think, and the Aziz Ansari situation is one of those where I just feel like we have got to do a better job educating. We have to start with our kids, you know, the little kids and our teenage boys and our teenage girls, and both sides have to start learning how to manage these situations differently. And I know that we have to be in a moment in time when this goes back to the pendulum swinging, that we have to be much more sensitive to the women than we have to be to the men, because for all these years, the women have been taken advantage of. But I do think, in addition to teaching men to behave properly and like mensches, I don't know how else to use that, we also need to be working with women to feel entitled to say what they are thinking.
Right. But I think going back to the affirmative consent question, I don't think it's really just about robotically saying yes and asking before each sexual encounter. It's about communication, you know, and checking in with your partner, making sure that everyone's on the same page and not assuming that sex is about getting as much as you can out of it. Yeah. Okay. We're going to bring up Talia in just a minute. I just want to sort of hit on the last point that we wanted to get to. There have been cases where men have been fired from their jobs or sort of their names dragged through the mud, where some people thought their behavior wasn't that bad or there wasn't, you know, evidence. They didn't get due process, right. Whatever. So I'm wondering, where do we draw those lines? Like, right. When is it okay to make something public? What's the standard of evidence that we need?
So I think a great place to turn for this is the Chafetz Chaim, who literally wrote the book on Lashon Hara. So actually, I went back to the Chafetz Chaim, the book, the Chafetz Chaim, to see what he said specifically.
You don't talk weekly to the Chafetz Chaim.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I meant whatever. Anyway, yeah. Okay. So, and, you know, just to, because I obviously knew what the basic answer was, but I wanted to see how he framed it. Excuse me, I just want to open this up, because don't worry, I'm not reading all that. just one or two phrases, because his basic point is that if you have firsthand knowledge of something, you are absolutely allowed and in many cases mandated for other people's safety and, you know, and so other people don't get hurt. He's talking primarily about financial issues, but other issues as well. Relates to dating, like doesn't even have to be about abuse. You know something about somebody that he's hiding from the man or woman that he or she is dating.
He's not actually a vegetarian.
Right. Something a little more significant. No. You know, there's a real Bein Adam L'Chavero, you know, interpersonal moral obligation to actually let the person know the risks that are involved if you have firsthand knowledge. So he lists a whole series of criteria to, you know, to check, like a checklist to make sure this is not Lashon Hara. And I just want to read one or two phrases, okay? He says, first of all, you're allowed to tell it. Yachol lesaper dvarim livnei adam kidei la'azur la'asher asham lo uleganot hamasim haraim. So the first thing he says is you're allowed to tell it to help the person who was injured, and in order, and this is interesting, not just to protect people in the future, but to make it clear that that behavior is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. Somebody did something, and I'm allowed to publicize it if I have firsthand knowledge so that the community should know that this behavior is unacceptable. So before I went back to read it, I had forgotten that line, but it just seems so appropriate. It's not just protecting in the concrete case. It's about a statement about what we will or won't tolerate as a community. But his basic rules are, and the relevant ones are, he says that you should, intent should be to help, not should be to spread bad, you know, to get revenge or whatever. It should be for positive purposes. And then here was one line that caught my attention. He says that the result of telling this does not lead to the person being more injured than he would if this case were brought to court. So if you stole from me, and I'm going to tell people, you know, watch out from Rebecca, she stole from me, I have firsthand knowledge, don't get into a business deal with her, and you suffer.
It's true, by the way.
And you suffer as a result more than you would suffer if the case was brought to court. He says, like, That's going overboard. Mm. So I don't know how you're supposed to do it, because sometimes you can't choose. Either you say nothing or you say something, and it is a little bit of an outside result. But I felt that spoke very much to what we're seeing. Somebody comes out with some accusation, and somebody, you know, loses their job, and sometimes the, you know, even for what might be a minor thing, and sometimes it feels like the result is a little disproportionate. So I'm not exactly sure how to address that, but it's really fascinating that he's aware of these issues and talking about them.
We'll be back with our guest, Talia Lakritz, after this quick word from our sponsors.
What was the last Shabbat table conversation that got you excited? Who was the last person to change your mind? When was the last time a Facebook post just didn't feel like the right medium for expressing your thoughts and feelings? If you have answers to these questions, and I know you do, then it's time to write for Jofa's blog at the Jewish Week. At Jofa's blog, we believe in catalyzing change in the Jewish community by giving voice to its members and inspiring conversations one blog post at a time. Bring your voice into the collective conversation and submit your piece today. For more information, email shira@jofa.org.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
Okay, so now we're really excited to welcome our special guest for this evening, Talia Lakritz.
Yay! I wish you move over.
Talia is a New York-based journalist. She's a writer for Insider and performer and activist. She created and co-hosts a bi-monthly Jewish women's sex book club that was recently featured in the Jewish Week. You might also know her as the singer-songwriter and YouTuber behind the viral hits such as Dear RCA, and 18 Things Orthodox Feminists Are Tired of Hearing. Her outspoken videos on feminism and LGBTQ+ issues in the Orthodox Jewish community have been featured on The Times of Israel, Everyday Feminism, The Huffington Post, and Yahoo News, and have done wonders for her shidduch resume. Her joke, not mine. So we're really excited to have Talia with us. So can you just explain what is a sex book club?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm a really big fan of the podcast, so this is really exciting for me, too. Jewish Women's Sex Book Club is a book club that I host in my apartment along with my roommate, Sarah Rosner. And each month, she can get some
shout
applause.
Shout out for Sarah Rosner. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And together, we pick a book that we think could spark some interesting discussions, not just about sexuality, but sexuality through the lens of Jewish women, though the club is open to women and gender nonconforming people as well. And then we just invite people to our living room, and we discuss. People bring brunch food, and we sit, and we talk about the book.
So I just need to say, when I heard that you were doing this book club, I think I was at a Monologues of the Makom, speaking of Sarah Rosner.
Monologues for the Makom, for anyone who doesn't know, is sort of like a Jewish vagina monologues. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's very accurate. they're working on a book right now, so that'll be coming out soon. So Talia mentioned to me that she's doing this women's book group, and I thought that was amazing, because more than anything else, since we started this podcast, one of the things I hear are that young people who grew up in the Orthodox community don't get good sex education and don't have a place to talk about it. And so this seemed like such a beautiful way to sort of deal with those issues. So what made you decide to do it?
Thank you. Well, I came across a TED Talk by Peggy Orenstein, and it was called What Young Women Believe About Their Own Sexual Pleasure. And it was about this idea of intimate justice, about how women should be empowered in all areas of their lives, including their sexual lives. And I saw that it was based on this book that she'd written called Girls and Sex. And I wanted to read it because her TED Talk was amazing. And I wanted to have people to talk about it with. So I messaged Sarah and I said, do you want to like do a Jewish women's sex book club thing? And she was like, yes. So that's pretty much how it happened.
So Could I ask what the Jewish part is? Is it because the book you mentioned
you're
isn't
Jewish?
That's the point. The book you mentioned isn't particularly a Jewish book, or right, isn't a Jewish book. Do you try to identify ones that sort of deal with the intersection of Judaism and sex, or really it's books that are about sex and that you as Jewish women are talking about it?
Yeah, we don't really have to try so hard to find those connections because they're all pretty much there. I mean, when we read Girls and Sex, it was very much about casual sex and consent and just what's sort of like to be in this world, in this like sexual landscape. And that brought up some conversations about like what that can look like in religious circles, like what can intimate justice, this idea that women should be empowered in all areas of their lives, including their sexual lives, what can that look like in an Orthodox community? And when we read Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski, she has this idea of your sexual life and ideas about it being sort of like a garden where you can water and tend to the ideas and influences that you want to keep in your life and maybe weed out the ones that maybe haven't been so positive. And there's definitely a lot to talk about there in terms of sex education or lack thereof in the Jewish community and messages that you get from all sorts of areas of religious life. And so really with every book we've read, there have been really great talking points, and we've never really had to try to make that connection. It's always pretty evident.
Right. Do you feel like the books you read or what you're learning combats messages that you got growing up from Judaism?
I mean, I can speak for myself, absolutely, in a positive way, I think, a lot of times. I mean, I went to a Beis Yaakov ultra-Orthodox high school. I did not receive any formal sex education. I mean, that was also a big part of why I wanted to start this book club. You know, also for myself, I think a lot of times when people in the religious community don't grow up with sex education, the conversation stops there. We just talk about how it's something that we never got, and we don't really take the next step of being like, oh, well, now this is my responsibility to educate myself. And so, I mean, as a lifestyle reporter, I was at one point writing a lot about sex and relationships and dating, and I was interviewing all sorts of relationship experts and things like that. And so I was learning a lot about it in a secular context, and I just wanted a space to learn more and discuss with people who sort of understood the world that I was coming from.
Are there any themes that have been emerging in terms of shared sort of experiences about how things could be better, how things could be different?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the main concern is that a lot of people just didn't have sex education growing up, and if they did, it wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of...
Do you feel like people talked about it? I know schools weren't doing it. Do you feel like, is there a mixture in terms of what people did have at home or didn't have at home, or it was pretty clear across the board nobody talked about sex?
I think it was pretty clear across the board. I mean, some people come from homes where it was a little bit more open, but I think across the board, there just needs to be a lot more conversation. I think there's so much fear around discussing sexuality, especially what I think part of what makes this book club unique is that it's open to all women and gender nonconforming people, regardless of relationship status, marital status, sexual orientation, level of experience. I think a lot of times I see whenever there's an event about some sort of sexual education topic, it's often only open to married people in the Orthodox community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge problem. And so that's part of why I'm very adamant about this club being open to everybody. I think it's so important that we have these conversations and keep them open to everyone so that there's not so much fear and shame surrounding these topics.
So there isn't a men's group. Now, you're not going to start the men's group, but... I'm wondering if you could speculate, is that because men don't tend to talk about this stuff with other men or in groups as much as women do? I think that's generally true. I also wonder if you think there might be a difference in terms of not that men get any better sex education than women growing up in terms of the Orthodox community, but maybe the messages don't leave them as conflicted as they leave women. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of your classic Orthodox sex education, men often walk away feeling like they have a lot of power mm-hmm. because the message often is that, women, as we've been talking about with this, Me Too stuff, that women are, it's a woman's responsibility to be the gatekeeper for men's sexuality. And I think as a woman, receiving that message for years and years, that really takes a toll on your self-image and your relationship with your sexuality. And so I would love to see a men's Jewish sex book club. I think that'd be fantastic. Maybe I'm not the right person to lead it, but
you can be a consultant to it.
Has anything surprised you that came out from the group?
I mean, one of the most surprising things is just like how excited and ready and enthusiastic people are about having these conversations. I think also something that was interesting for me is just how broad the interest was religiously. Like, we have people who grew up Orthodox and are Orthodox, people who grew up Orthodox and aren't anymore, people who didn't grow up Orthodox and are now, people who haven't had anything to do with Orthodoxy, and just so many different religious perspectives is a really valuable thing, but also how similar the struggles are across the board. Even if you didn't grow up, like I did, going to a Beis Yaakov where you didn't receive any sex education, like the broader world clearly still has a lot of issues with sex education. So obviously nowhere is perfect. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in all spheres, religious and non-religious.
We'll be back with more from Talia Lakritz and a Q&A with our audience after this brief message from our sponsor.
Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is proud of its new class of 12 rabbis, which brings our total to 120 rabbis now serving Jewish communities. These modern Orthodox rabbis are making a difference in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovevei Torah rabbi, come visit us and see what we're all about. For source sheets to accompany the Joy of Text episodes and for other great Torah, visit our Torah library at www.yctorah.org.
Has there ever come a time where somebody sort of actually referred to either halacha or some part of Jewish tradition or teaching to say, actually, here's where I think, you know, this is an important corrective to certain attitudes in the outside society, where we can be sort of, you know, learning something that we're not being taught from the broader messaging that we're getting?
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice thing about having this discussion sort of in context with people who sort of speak that language a little bit more. It came up actually in our most recent book club where we were reading Mating in Captivity by Esther Perel. And her main idea is that you always want what you can't have. And so maintaining some sort of distance in relationships is really important for that relationship to thrive. And obviously that brought up ideas of Nida and ideas of Shomer Negiya and those halachic ideas of separation. So we had a really interesting conversation about how those forms can be helpful and positive, but also how they can be really damaging and complex. So yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, wisdom in a lot of what Judaism and halacha has to say about sexuality.
You had a meeting that was specifically about Me Too. What sort of came out of that? Were there any big takeaways?
I mean, as with any discussion about Me Too, we talked a lot about how it had just been impacting us, just like being on the internet and seeing like streams of stories and like one man after another. I mean, like for me personally, working in a newsroom, it got to a point where someone would just say a man's name and everyone would go, oh. So it was just a really, really hard, intense time, I think, for a lot of people. So just kind of having space to process that was a big part of what we were trying to do. And I think also, as with any good discussion about a really nuanced, difficult topic, we didn't really come to any strong conclusions. It was more just creating a space to process what had been going on and what we were feeling about it, you know, both how the movement had been empowering and emboldening, but also, you know, people, it giving people pause in some ways and people having their issues with the movement as a whole or certain aspects of it.
So on that note, this is a very complicated topic. We've talked about a lot of stuff, and we'd really love to hear from you guys in the audience. We're going to pass around this mic. So we have our first commentator.
Hi. So my name is Jenny. I was wondering specifically something you were talking about in terms of how folks are reacting to the Me Too movement and in terms of how to process the people who are involved in a particular situation. I think that it's really important in what you said about sort of prioritizing the needs of the victim in the situation that's happened. I'm wondering, though, if you could speak more to a model that accounts for also paying attention to the needs of the aggressor in the sense of a lens towards tshuva and restorative justice, that actually by paying attention to both parties in this action, it is a way that in turn, each of them is healed, instead of sort of maybe the victim ultimately finds some sort of reconciliation and some healing, and the other person is sort of maybe drops out of communal life, is like struggling a lot personally, or even maybe they just pick up and go to a completely new community and will repeat that assault, God forbid.
Well, do you know what I'm saying? I think we've seen, I mean, if you've been sensitive in trying to read those articles, we have been seeing a lot of articles about, from men talking about, you know, I never thought I abused anybody. Then I kind of did a reckoning and I really think back to a situation where I really took advantage of somebody, or men saying I've gotten totally paranoid. Like, I think there's a huge range. I think you're going to have some men who probably have been regular aggressors who maybe are somehow realizing that their behavior is not acceptable and are trying to deal with that. You're going to have some men who generally weren't aggressors but have had situations where they were behaving inappropriately and are kind of doing a reckoning of that now too. And then I think you're also going to have, I guess maybe this is a little off topic, so somebody can push me back, but I do worry a little bit about some of the young men in terms of a level of fear and paranoia. I was talking to a friend of mine's son maybe a month or two ago, and he's 23. He's a sweetheart. And he said to me, I'm afraid to get into any sexual relationships at all at this point. He said, I'm almost paralyzed. He said, I'm always afraid I'm not going to pick up signals and I should be checking more and asking more. And I'm even afraid that even if I do all that, that I'll wake up the next morning, I'll be accused of doing something that I don't think I did. I just feel like I can't, I'm having a hard time being sexual. And I worry about that as somebody who sees people from all walks of life. I think this has been a really important time for people to start looking at the behavior. I don't know how much you can force people to do that, but it seems to me like it's really, really happening. I mean, it seems to me like men, for the most part, are looking at the behavior and thinking about it differently and are just having their limits pushed up higher, don't you think?
I'm trying to have a lot of thoughts. I think
it's a really good question. Yeah. If you're making us struggle.
So, look, I think that the care for the man is, we can talk about it at a couple of planes. First, you know, the one issue that we've been dealing with is when there's an accusation out there, you know, how much are we applying the normal types of rules of due process and making sure, you know, verifying the accusation, having the right type of measured response and so on. And, you know, that has to do with the overcorrecting. But obviously a major teaching of halacha, I would say, is two things, you know, as a general rule, which not at all going against my point that maybe, you know, there has to be overcorrection right now. But a general teaching of halacha certainly is that there's a lot of protection about somebody in terms of accusations. You need a lot of direct evidence before you decide that somebody is guilty. Also that even when somebody is guilty and is being prosecuted by the courts, that the rule of ahavta l'reacha kamocha sort of dictates love your neighbor as yourself, even for this guilty person, and even as they are sort of being punished, and even if they're being put to death, you know, that sort of dictates all along the way how we have to feel about, you know, and how sensitive we have to be to, regardless of what this person has done, you know, he's a fellow human being and we have to have the right level of concern. So that's one point. The other thing I'd like to say is the tshuva point is that, yeah, we have a lot to learn from the halachas of tshuva, because the first beginning of the halachas of tshuva is that if you injure another person, you have to directly approach that person and apologize, and not only apologize, apologies only go so far. The person might not want to or be prepared to or ever be prepared to give forgiveness. But the other thing that you have to do is you have to do everything in your ability to rectify it. And, you know, people have said, like, well, if Weinstein starts by donating all of his fortune to these causes, then we could start talking about him really doing tshuva. So I certainly think that looking at that as a model about if somebody is really wants to be accepted and have they really sort of repented, is how much are they really doing to rectify what they've done in the past. And the final thing I'll say about the tshuva issue is that a lot of the classic tshuva discussion in the Talmud is about what a person has to do to be forgiven by God. And when the Talmud gets to issues about what does a person have to do if they have somehow acted acted in a way that violated the trust of the community, the standard is a lot higher. Because God might forgive you, but you know what? I'm not God. I hope you've done a real tshuva, and I hope you're sincere, and I hope God forgives you. But if you want me as a community member to trust you again, I'm going to need to see a lot more if you want me to restore my trust in you. So I think that that's also a really important point around in this discussion.
And there's been a lot of, I think we've seen how different men who are accused of things have reacted differently, and some have been much more convincing and satisfying than others. And to your point about the different levels of tshuva, there's, especially for people who are famous or prominent in some way, they have to apologize to their victims, and they also have to apologize to the public for letting us down, because I think we've held up a lot of these people and ways. So
somebody said to me the other day, if I hear that Tom Hanks abused somebody, I'm going to kill myself.
Any other?
Hi, my name's Ni'ima. I wanted to touch on the education point about consent and like what we say to young children, what we say as parents and as educators. I find that in my classroom, when I'm in the position of teaching, I teach Hebrew school, and I find myself saying a lot, hands to yourself, we don't touch other people. But it just gets lost, and at some point, it's hard to turn everything into a teachable moment. And like, these are second and third graders, and I find that a lot of times my peers, my co-teachers, are not necessarily not always thinking of the same things I am, like about consent and about certain things. And I guess I struggle with, like, at what point do we educate the educators? One person in a classroom can only go so far. We need the whole team to be behind that. And like, I guess I'm wondering what thoughts are and how to make, like, in a tachless, practical way, how to make that happen.
I mean, I feel for you. I mean, I get it. Like, you feel like you're up against a tidal wave. Like, you're trying to get certain messages across, and you're kind of alone in doing that. You have to just keep doing it. That's just the life of somebody who's trying to make change. And it's hard and it's frustrating. And maybe as you become a more senior teacher, then you can then be out there teaching the teachers on how to handle this stuff.
Not to directly respond, but to deal with the case you're describing, I want to share a point that came up recently at Chovei Torah, when one of our life cycles classes, where we were dealing with this and with sort of sexuality and young adults and people who are going to work with kids. And, you know, somebody pointed out that like, we lose something, and I'm not saying that we should not be doing exactly what you're talking about, but we also, you know, we lose something in the equation, especially if we're trying to be sort of gender parity. So does that mean that now, like, a kindergarten teacher, a woman can't have a girl sit on her lap and a man can't have a boy sit on his lap, you know? And, like, so, like, I don't know the answer to that, but I just wanted to put that out there.
I'm from a Reconstructionist background, which is a little less focused on rules. And I was wondering your thoughts about the role of empathy in this whole thing, because a lot of what we've been talking about is how regulations can be preventative and solve a problem. But the one thing that hasn't been addressed is I feel your pain and, like, I'm sorry for you. And I was wondering how you think that fits into all of this.
So I'm happy to say, like, I feel like that seems totally clear to me, that there should always be as much support given to victims as possible. You know, and what's fascinating is that different people can have different levels of responses to different activities. Something that somebody else may not really make them feel uncomfortable can make somebody else really uncomfortable. And I feel like as a community and as any kind of institution, our responsibility is to be as, you know, as empathetic as possible and help the person get the help that they need and be there as a support for the person. That feels pretty clear to me.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And certainly the rabbi's responsibility to do everything he can to give the type of support and strength to the person. And well, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
So just to clarify your last answer, the rabbi should do everything he or she can.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I stand corrected.
That's all right. So my name is Risha.
They, and he or she or they.
Correct. Yes. Thank you. So on that note, I think my name is Risha. What I wanted to propose here is that the Me Too movement that we're seeing is obviously a very important correction of what we're seeing, like the centrality of this charismatic male figure who can get away with anything because of the existing power structures in place. And I think, like, I appreciate that we keep coming back to halacha, and is that something that can help us prevent sexual abuse, but is it also something that is encouraging it, not just because of rules like SNEAS, you know, and objectification, but also a culture that's enforced where if you spend your entire life being told that your utmost invalidation will be, you know, when your shidduch resume reaches the top of the pile, and being told that having a male partner or male validation is important, then that can create a lot of mixed signals when you go into the workplace, when you're dealing with men who might break boundaries when you're in a situation where it's about a job, it's about a community position, and women don't feel like they can actually speak up. And it's interesting that we haven't seen any big, I mean, we've seen a few, but in the Jewish community, there hasn't been the outpouring that I expect will happen. And how are we going to handle it when so much of community...
The outpouring of...
Of accusations, of allegations. And what's going to happen when it takes down that charismatic male rabbi figure that we're so attached to?
So I think we have seen it in the Jewish community. There was the Baruch Lanner case that came out years ago, and there were two or three major serious rabbis in Israel recently who also incredibly charismatic, who also sort of fell on sexual issues with women. So I think we are seeing it, and I still don't have an answer on what will happen. I think a lot of what you said is very valid. I don't think it's in the Jewish community. I don't think halacha has been great at keeping this at bay. I think it just is part of it.
And the one comment I'll make, which I think was maybe the subtext or maybe the comment you made before, is I actually think that having women in the rabbinate in whatever capacity is a very important corrective to exactly what you're talking about. So.
This is a joint question. Yes? No? Okay. All right. Well, I guess what I'm curious about, in my mind, power plays a huge role in what we've seen in Me Too, in the unmasking of all of these men, and particularly, I guess I'm wondering what you think about the role of power in these situations. How to prevent people in power from using that power in you know evil ways or poor ways. And also, I think just jumping off of the question that was asked earlier about sort of rabbinic figures who are charismatic. I think a lot of, particularly in Israel, on gap year programs, there are many, you know, charismatic rabbinic figures. Some of them are in girls' seminaries, some in boys. And how do you train students to have, in those settings or in elementary school, whatever level, how do you train them to have, you know, critical thinking about their leaders?
Oh, my God. That is a huge question in the last minute. You know, I mean... I think you're 100% right, Hody, that power plays a major part in this. We love strong, powerful leaders, and then we fall victims to those strong, powerful leaders. And maybe part of the answer will be having a more equal power base, you know, more women and more men working together. Maybe that in itself will be the reality. We need to teach our kids, and this I just keep going back, to think a little bit more critically, to challenge, to not fall prey to, you know, sort of the powerful, charismatic person, and sort of accept that anything they say is God's gift to the world because they happen to be smart and powerful. Like it doesn't feel to me like there are shortcuts here. Like that's the reality. I think it has to do with teaching our kids to be critical thinkers about everything, about sex, about being touched, about the way people think. Like you just need to teach your kids to be critical thinkers. And I just feel like that goes a long way, but it's a huge question. That's not a minute and a half ending question, but thank you for it.
Next episode?
Yeah, next episode.
Okay, I think we have to wrap up. Everyone is invited. We have a reception with wine sponsored by Twin Sons, which is delicious and kosher. And thank you very much.
Everybody could use wine at this point.
Yeah, we wanted to have it before to loosen you all up, but it didn't work out.
Thank you so much, Talia.
Yeah, Talia.
Wait, if people want to reach Talia, either to learn how to run a book club or because they want to attend your book club.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Nerd With A Voice.
Nerd with
I'm
a voice.
I'm pretty easy to stalk online if you try hard enough.
So, and I want to thank the JCC for having us, hosting us.
And we'll stay around for a while if people want.
And we're going to be here drinking wine, eating some cookies. So please stick around if you have, we can continue the conversation offline.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.
And let's have an applause for you, but louder. Yeah. Come on.
Thank you to the JCC Manhattan for hosting this live episode and to our guest, Talia Lakritz. This episode of The Joy of Text was recorded by Matt Temkin and produced and edited by me, Rebecca Honig-Friedman. If you have a question or comment you'd like to share with us, you can do so anonymously at thejoyoftext.org or send us a regular email at joyoftextpodcast@gmail.com. The Joy of Text is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, or any podcast app. If you like what you hear, show your support by giving us a 5-star rating, and stay up to date with our latest episodes and live events by following us on Facebook or Twitter.